So I took the title of the conference, The Puzzles, quite seriously when I was trying to compose the slides or the narrative arc for the talk. And I thought I would focus on some of the things that I find a bit puzzling about black holes and black hole thermodynamics, and that I would frame this around what I was asked to talk about, which is some of the work that I've been doing on the thermodynamics of accelerating black holes, which brings in some ideas from holography and also, I think, really extends this landscape of black hole thermodynamics. So I've put my various partners in crime at the bottom. Some of them either are still around here in Waterloo or were in the past, in particular Rob Mann and David Kubiznik, but here's also a whole list of other people who've contributed to some of the things that I talk about. So I'm actually an unrepentant fan of black holes. I always have found them absolutely fascinating. I think, you know, they're not obviously manifestations of strong gravity, but it's where we go turn to, if you like, often as a lab when we think about ideas in quantum gravity. And what I find particularly interesting about black hole thermodynamics is that it is an odd mix of classical techniques with quantum interpretations. And so that's kind of what I want to talk around for the next 25 minutes or so. So just to start with, I'm not going to dig into this, but my question, so what do I mean by classicality of black hole thermodynamics? So here I'm just going to give this in a very simplified argument to just illustrate how often practitioners of black hole thermodynamics, when we're thinking about the first law or whatever, it's a very classical type of argument. We take the metric of a black hole and we do the Bardeen-Carter-Hawking type of game, where we ask what happens if we do something to our black hole, if we throw something into it or change its environment in some way. So we have this family of metrics. So in this case, I've taken the Schwarzschild ADS example. So this is our potential. We have a mass parameter, and we also have the ADS part, the length scale, the curvature of the background space-time. So our black hole is defined by, in this family of metrics, by F equals zero. And we say, well, let's look at a small change in F, and our horizon at the end is still going to be F equals zero. And so we simply write our F of R plus a little increment in the horizon radius. This is still going to be zero. So we have a change in R plus, potentially a change in the M parameter, and also potentially a change in the length parameter. We then look at what those mean. So we take, usually when we calculate temperatures, we simply Euclideanize our metric and ask that the horizon is regular to get a natural periodicity. We associate that periodicity with a temperature, and hence we get our TDS term. So this is the Gibbons-Hawking approach as developed in the 70s. The cosmological constant defines a pressure term, and this then gives us a first law width of TDS plus VdP. And so we're led to identify M with enthalpy rather than internal energy. But this argument is still quite classical. Oh, I keep wanting to walk to change. Okay, So I think it's interesting to dig deeper. So these were some of the questions. I mean, I guess I'm looking forward to the panel discussion later this morning and also the discussion this afternoon. So I'm sort of giving away some of my questions or puzzles, but I think it's just, what does DP mean? I think that's sort of reasonably clear, but I've got a couple of slides just to talk around that. The bulk of the talk is thinking about composite systems. Even a black hole in de Sitter space is in some sense composite because there's more than one horizon, but you can also have non-isolated black holes, which is what I'll focus on mainly. Then there are questions about what around the first law, is that unique? You know, is the process that we use to find it, that classical process that I just quickly reviewed, is that reasonable? And also, just questions about what M is. What do we really mean by M or DM? So those I'll only address very briefly at the end, if I have time. So DP, I think this is about how to vary lambda. I talked a bit about this yesterday, to the strong gravity group, just very briefly. Some of the work that I did a few years back with David Castor and Jenny Trashen, we looked at how to change, looked at sort of dynamical thermodynamics, where we take a black hole with a scalar field and we change the mass and we change lambda. And so here the idea is simply, because you hear people say, how can you change the cosmological constant? Well, we do it all the time. Inflation changes lambda, and we do it with a slowly rolling scalar field. And I think what is interesting is that you can find solutions, perturbative solutions, that have a varying horizon area, a varying mass, a varying lambda, and they give you a sort of continuous or a differential form of the first law. You find that your M dot is related to an area change and a lambda change. So I just wanted to pop that up because that addresses some of the questions that some people have around DP. Yes, you can change your local pressure by simply having your cosmological constant viewed as a vacuum energy rather than just as a constant. So I just wanted to flag that in case anyone was wondering, why are you thinking about changing lambda? Well, we do so. So moving to the composite systems, this is actually some work that ended up being a lot more involved than probably we thought at the beginning. David Kubisnik and I were thinking about a claim that black holes could be superentropic. So this is looking at a particular limit of a rotating black hole in anti-de Sitter, but the idea was that the black hole could somehow have more entropy than it was supposed to. And as part of that, we started thinking about a black hole with conical deficits and how you could take extreme limits of those solutions. So the C metric, this is an accelerating black hole, it's one of these oddities, if you like, on the black hole landscape. So it is a metric in general which describes a black hole that is not isolated. It's a composite black hole. You have, if you look at this metric, so I wrote down, again, avoiding rotation, a relatively simple form of one of these accelerating black holes. So what I want you to sort of focus on is here is this Newtonian potential, which if A was zero would be that Schwarzschild anti-de Sitter potential. But this capital A tells you something about acceleration. So looking at what's going on here, the things that you notice are that you have a conformal factor in front of the metric, or the coordinate pieces, and the angular part of the metric has been modified. So here, this G, if MA is non-zero distorts the two spheres. And so this is kind of represented by these distorted horizons, this cartoon in the top corner. The prefactor, omega, this tells you something about what's happening to the boundary of ADS. Because you see that in the lower half, if you like, of the cylinder, when theta's bigger than pi on 2, you can, do I mean it that way around? You can get omega going to zero at finite r. So I think I mean it that way around. I'm blanking. So what that means is that suddenly your boundary is now at some finite radius, and conversely, in the other half of the cylinder, you can actually go to r equals infinity without having, without reaching the ADS boundary. So here, this whole metric, this is a sort of rewriting of the classic relativist C metric in such a form that you sort of recognize the various metric potentials. So I just want to focus on two aspects. So first, I'm going to forget about acceleration, set A to zero, and focus on this K here. So we put K in the metric because we wanted to have this phi angle having periodicity 2 pi. So quite often, if you have a non-compact coordinate, you can sort of rescale it, and the only way that you decide what its normalization is by some, with respect to some reference frame, usually asymptotic. However, if your coordinate is compact, then what you don't want is, in a family of metrics, the range of that coordinate changing. So you put a K here so that phi is a conventional azimuthal coordinate. So what is the effect of K? As you go to theta is zero, or indeed pi, you find that the theta phi part of the metric almost looks like the origin in polar coordinates, but the K, if it's not equal to one, changes that. And what it does is it introduces a conical singularity. If K is bigger than one, it's a deficit, and that is associated to something with positive energy and positive tension. And so this is often, conical deficits are often called cosmic strings. Slightly, it's more or less okay to do that identification, although there's a few provisos. But in essence, if you have an old-fashioned cosmic string, a defect in vacuum defect in field theory, you can relate this K to the tension mu of the string. So your deficit angle is actually related to a physical object. And so that is just a sort of essence. What does the string do? The K cuts out a little slice from space and leaves you with this little cone when you re-identify. So the key thing is it produces no long-range space-time curvature. So that's the cosmic string. And so if you have thermodynamics with a string, you do the same process. You see that F hasn't changed, so you have the same relation as before, but what changes is the entropy. So the entropy goes down if you have one of these deficits, and that's kind of, and also actually the mass is going to change. So this conical deficits in entropy was actually explored in an old paper by Hedero et al. And so when you want to relate the change in the horizon radius to the change in entropy, you also pick up the change in this K. And so we identify changes in K with changes in tension. And if you want to think of a process, a dynamical process, that might change tension, you could imagine a string that gets hooked onto a black hole. The string can then keep moving, and it kind of slides off the black hole, but it leaves a little bit, if you like, of itself behind. And so this is an example where the tension might change. So you can think of processes involving a changing tension with the black hole. So again, you get the P and V terms, and you find a new first law, which takes into account ds, dp, and now this delta mu, the tension of this string potentially running through the black hole. And again, you see now that the mass is no longer the direct mass parameter in the potential, the F, but it's now divided by K, which makes sense if you imagine collapsing shells to form a black hole, because the shells have now had a little segment cut out of them, so they have less energy. So this is all completely understandable. There's nothing mysterious going on, but it's now introduced a new thermodynamic charge that doesn't appear in the Smar relation. And we associated the potential with that charge as a thermodynamic length in analogy with the thermodynamic volume that pre-multiplies the dp term. So this is all completely consistent with the interpretation of M as enthalpy. If the black hole grows, it swallows some string, but it's also displaced the same amount of energy from the environment. So just as a recap, we've derived here thermodynamics of a non-isolated black hole. It's threaded by a cosmic string. The string just joins in with all the thermodynamics. It has its own charge, the tension, and its own potential. So here, the metric had three free parameters, M, L, and K, and we have three charges, M, P, and mu. And I'm just spelling it out because it's important to note that when we're doing thermodynamics, this is what we would say it has full cohomogeneity. In other words, degrees of freedom of your solution are the same as the degrees of freedom of the thermodynamics. So what happens with the accelerating black holes? And in case you haven't spent as much time with the C metric as I have, let me just quickly remind ourselves of what we mean by acceleration. If you remember, acceleration is when you're on a non-geodesic. So in other words, the tangent vector, the derivative of the tangent vector along its length is not actually proportional to the tangent vector. So as an example, if I stand in ADS, displaced from the center, so this is my ADS metric, I stand at some R naught, the tangent vector is purely time-like if I just stay there, but the acceleration is radial. So here, I'm not moving, but I'm accelerating. And so this is the picture. An observer displaced from the center of ADS is an accelerating observer, just like we are standing on the surface of the Earth. The magnitude of the acceleration is related to the displacement from the origin, measured in, of course, the units of the ADS curvature. So this is an example of a Rindler spacetime, but it has no horizon. So it's called slowly accelerating Rindler. So here, if we took our original form of the C metric, I've slipped in a little constant there, come back to that. This is our original C metric with no mass. We just have the conformal factor. We have the round two sphere. This is our potential. Then we do a coordinate transformation, because I said this was Rindler. It should just be ADS in new coordinates. So I do this transformation to capital R and capital theta, and that recovers global ADS. And I identify that rescaling, this T is that T, provided alpha squared is 1 minus A squared L squared. So what that tells you is that the original form without the alpha, the T in this sort of original C metric ticks, the clock ticks at a different rate to the global clock. So by doing this coordinate transformation, we correctly normalize the time in the original coordinate system. So this is what it looks like. This is my ADS cylinder. And here is, these are the C coordinates. They're centered around the observer who's displaced from the origin of ADS. And we sort of see that here we can go to infinity and beyond as we go up in the upper half of the cylinder. And in the lower half of the cylinder, the boundary is at finite R. And so this is our slowly accelerating Rindler space. The black hole simply adds a little black hole displaced from the center. And how is it suspended? Well, it's in this case, I've just drawn a string from one pole. And you sort of have this picture of it being suspended from the boundary by this conical deficit. So the string tension, if you like, provides the force that holds the black hole off center. So I've kind of set up the geometry, and now it's sort of, I'm going to at least walk or skate over the calculations because, you know, some of them were fairly lengthy. Okay, so how do we get acceleration? What we do is we've got our k, but if m and a are both non-zero, and you look at what happens at the poles, you see that going to theta zero or theta equals pi, you have different values of the multiplying factor to d phi squared, which tells you you have different deficits. And so it is the difference, this mismatch of tensions that gives you a net force in one direction or the other. And quite often what you see is that one axis is made regular with the deficit on the other axis. But I'm just going to note that is in fact a constrained system because you've made one axis regular. You can, in general, solution will have defects on both axes. So the full singing, dancing C metric also includes rotation. Again, I stress we put in this alpha because we know that potentially in this frame, the clock ticks at a different rate compared to an observer at the boundary of ADS. So this impacts on calculations of the temperature and the mass. This is just the formula for the metric. And so what you have to do is then crank the handle and find out what happens in this, following that same methodology of saying, if I throw something into the black hole, how does everything change? And do I get a consistent first law? So in terms, again, we do, if we find the entropy, we find that not only does it have a bit dependent on k, but the acceleration starts coming into play. The temperature, again, we've got terms involving acceleration. And what is the mass? Well, in this case, we kind of used a variety of approaches to start exploring this. The one I've just focused on writing here is doing a holographic renormalization to find m. So this is simply where we take our coordinates and we transform them into, if you like, ADS-CFT style coordinates. So z equals zero represents the boundary. Xi is like a cos of some new angle. And we simply go order by order, finding these various functions. So f and g are determined by requiring that we have no cross terms with z. Our z is just simply, I guess it's got l squared there. And so that our metric asymptotically has this form, we can calculate gamma, we can calculate psi and m mu nu, which is what we do. This is what we get for the boundary metric, which has an anisotropic boundary fluid stress tensor. And we find, we identify what the energy of that is and integrate up to get the mass. And then, so this is what the stress tensor looks like. And on doing that, we find that at least if we set our A and E, et cetera, to zero, we get this alpha M on K. And again, we compare, we essentially have to sort of look at various different limits to find this alpha. So these are our general thermodynamic parameters. Skip through, as you can imagine, all this glorious algebra to get these. But you see what comes up is that we have our mass, only it depends on the little m and little k. We also get these rotational factors. So if you forgot about the acceleration, this would be the Gibbons-Perry-Pope thermodynamic mass. And so, in fact, we borrowed a lot from some of the ideas that they used to get a consistent first law. So our alpha, in a sense, is determined by giving us a consistent first law, but also we are able to transform, these are our thermodynamic parameters in terms of the metric parameters, but you can also find chemical expressions where you have your charges, which is Q, P, S, and also this the C and the delta represent an average and differential conical deficit. And so all the potentials and the mass are representable in terms of these chemical expressions. And so I would say that therefore means that we have a fully consistent thermodynamic interpretation. Just to quickly note that actually, although what we focused on slowly accelerating black holes, because we wanted to make sure that we had one horizon and therefore our thermodynamics was well defined, if you just instead think about multiple horizons, even if they're at different temperatures, I just want to point out that there we can also do thermodynamics of a whole array of black holes. And so an array of black holes can be represented in this vial coordinate system as a series of rods lying along an axis. And so again, hefty algebra, you find that you've got a composite first law where you sum TDS and the lambda d mu, so these are all the tensions. If you sum that up, you get a dm, a sort of total mass expression. And this is sort of saying that, you know, if you in this system, if you change one black hole, it has a sort of ripple effect on the whole system. And so the thermodynamics has to sum up everything that's going on. So this is just an example with three black holes. Now, I'm guessing I'm running out of time, so I just want to start recapping. So here, again, for the charged, rotating, slowly accelerating C metric, we have six parameters. We've got the mass, we've got the ADS length scale, we have the charge, we have rotation, we have acceleration, we have the conical deficit. And we also have six thermodynamic charges. And this enabled us to go back to the, the superentropic solution. And we kind of discovered that that did not have full cohomogeneity. And that was in part responsible for some of the bizarre thermodynamic properties. And in general, when you sort of see something odd being claimed, you have to look carefully. And I would claim that it's related to hidden non-full cohomogeneity. So just coming back to the two last puzzles, you know, so I guess that I've already said that bit. Just to come back to some of the final thoughts, what is DM? The original discussion of Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking gave a very clear relation of DM, and that was in terms of the energy of infalling matter, which was unambiguous because you measure mass at infinity. For de Sitter, though, or for some more complex spacetimes, it's a little less clear. And I just wanted to point out that you could use that slow roll solution to explore ideas around DM. And so what we found, and I'm going to skip through this, is that if you have energy crossing the horizon, this does not contribute to DM, but rather to DS. So I think that's another puzzle. And since I would like to end on time, I'm just, and also I think I'm about to have a coughing fit. I shall put up my summary slide and end here.
Thank you very much, Ruth.
Okay, now yes. So we have time for questions, either here or where we start from eBay.
So thanks, Ruth. I was wondering about the Euclideanization. I mean, of course, the whole metric discussion you had was that was just strictly Lorentzian, right? Your presentation. But then you want to relate to thermodynamics and said, okay, now I use standard Euclideanization. Okay, so, and then you treated, I guess, the absence of another horizon as meaning there is a well-defined thermodynamic. So it's a, but I was wondering, you're doing more, right? You're cutting out this edge. So is it in what mathematical sense, you know, what is your Wick rotation? So that still extends in a unique way.
So the Wick rotation of which, the slowly accelerating solution or?
Well, I guess your comments in the end, well, where about it? But you never said very explicitly what you meant by there is a good, you know, thermodynamic interpretation. So what are you tying that to? The existence of a well-defined analytic continuation of the metric you're having there? For any of the cases you're discussing, really.
So I'm not sure I'm getting the question. In terms of the single slowly accelerating black hole, there's no ambiguity with the Euclideanization because there's just the one horizon.
And you just smooth it, you just require it to be smoothed out.
And that's the usual trick. For the composite system, instead, it's saying that you would go to each individual horizon and locally do that, but that is obviously not the same as saying that you're doing a Euclideanization of the full solution, because if you do that, you'll get conical deficits at the various horizons. Mm. Now, it's a completely different story, but that doesn't necessarily faze me because I can actually integrate the action over a conical deficit. But it does, I think that I'm very cautious about using Euclidean techniques. Because, you know, I think as long as you're sort of very careful and you kind of use them with suitable caution, you usually get sensible or apparently sensible results. But I do have a lot of reservations, not so much about using it as a tool, but how much we should take the Euclidean section literally, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, it is something where I would say, well, you can see with body language.
Well, I agree very much, but of course, non-uniqueness is also an issue, right? If there are choices, right? The conical singularities, there could be features. Maybe there are features that want to tell you something rather than you arguing them away. Maybe you should take them, you know, more literally. Yeah, that's another possibility, yeah. I would say.
Sorry, I really struggle with the acoustics in here.
Okay, let's talk in the coffee break.
Yeah.
Okay. So, long time ago, Terry and Ray and I had looked at the global solution of C-metric. That was the first analysis of this metric. And then what we found was that one could actually have one other choice. You can have what we call rubber bands, what you have, which is to say something which is going from the node to out to infinity, or you could have a strut in between. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that you're analysis will go through even with the strut because you presented with the strings. Is that correct?
I guess so. I personally like to always have positive energy objects. That's just my personal preference.
No, but there's no difference in the energy here.
Sorry?
There is no difference. I mean, in both cases, you will have something going out to infinity, which is not regular. In one case, it is going out to infinity. In the other case, it is in between.
Yes, but the one in between has notionally a negative energy.
But the total energy is fine.
Right, but the object in between has negative energy. The thing with the positive tension ones is that if you don't like having singularities, you can replace the conical deficit with an actual cosmic strain. So it gives you, you know, you can then regard this as a legitimate, regular physical system, albeit being very close to a singular one. And so I guess, you know, it, yes, you can do it for a strut. However, I guess in the narrative here, it was trying to stick with something where we know that it can be replaced by a regular positive, you know, positive energy object.
And my impression was that although you used a negative cosmological constant, that was not essential for the whole analysis. Is that correct?
No,
is that
not? It's not essential. I think we used that initially because we, you know, when you're trying to figure out how the system behaves, you want to make sure that, you know, you're not introducing extra complications. But yes, I mean, we did sort of think about what would happen with the acceleration horizon. I think other people have come along and also explored that. But then you get into some of the questions that Renato was raising.
No, but in those questions, you can just work in the Lorentzian domain. And
so you're
work.
Saying sort of step back and take the global picture. Yeah, you could do that.
And look at the Lorentzian domain and define surface gravity as a temperature. And
True.